All right, so let's set a scene. I think you know the one.
Okay.
You're on a road trip, right?
Yeah.
Been driving for, I don't know, 4, maybe 5 hours.
The highway hypnosis is kicking in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the highway starts to slow down. You see the exit sign for some town you've never even heard of. Any town, USA.
You need gas or maybe just a coffee to stay awake.
Yeah, something. You take that exit, and right there, just past the speed limit sign, you always see it. That one specific sign.
The welcome to sign. Usually it's wood, sometimes metal, but it's always cluttered.
Fluttered is the perfect word. It's like this visual roll call. You've got the blue gear wheel for
The Rotary Club.
the Rotary Club, right? You've got that big L for the
The
Lions.
K for Kewaunee's.
Yep. Maybe the Elks Lodge number or that little Shriners logo with the scimitar. It is, I think, the most ubiquitous piece of decor in the entire American landscape.
It really is. We see them, we register them as just wholesome,
Yeah.
small town America.
Wholesome is the word. It signals pancake breakfasts, charity drives for the local school.
Maybe some old guys driving those tiny cars in a 4th of July parade.
Exactly. That's the surface perception. It's the Norman Rockwell painting of civic life. We see them as the fabric of the community.
They're the people who fund the new scoreboard for the high school football field, that kind of thing.
Right. But today, for this deep dive, we are going to take a sledgehammer to that Norman Rockwell painting.
Okay.
Because the source material we are unpacking argues that those signs aren't just a collection of random benevolent clubs. The argument is that they are nodes.
Nodes in a network.
Exactly. Visible terminals and a massive designed and historically entrenched network. And when you start connecting those nodes, you don't get a picture of charity, you get a schematic of
It's
control.
a structural analysis of power hiding in plain sight.
And before we even get into the mechanics of this supposed machine, we have to talk about who is handing us the blueprints.
The source.
Yeah, the source. Because usually when you get into a topic like secret societies, you kind of expect the author to be, well, I don't know, a guy in a basement with a lot of red string and thumbtacks.
The classic conspiracy theorist stereotype.
Right. But this source is very different. We're looking at an article called Secret Societies in Modern Masonry, and the author writes under the pen name Mrs. Heritage History.
Which sounds very quaint, almost like a grandmother telling stories from the old days.
It does. But her resume is formidable. She is a distinguished homeschool teacher and historian, and she's the archivist behind a website called heritagehistory.com.
I've looked at it. It's a massive undertaking. She has personally preserved over 500 rare pre-1923 student histories.
Think about that, the amount of work. She's dedicated to saving these, traditional historical perspectives that have largely been scrubbed from the modern curriculum.
Project of passion.
But here's the detail that really stopped me in my tracks. She isn't just a historian. She is a graduate of Stanford University with honors in engineering.
And that's the key. That one specific detail, Stanford Engineering, it changes the entire lens through which you have to read this text.
Explain that. Why does an engineering degree matter so much for a history article?
Because engineers, by their very nature and training, don't believe in coincidences. They believe in systems.
Okay.
If a bridge collapses, an engineer doesn't just say, "Oh, bad luck." They look for the structural flaw. They analyze the load-bearing columns, the stress
You
points.
reverse engineer the failure.
Precisely. So when Mrs. Heritage History looks at the American political landscape, she isn't seeing a messy, organic evolution of clubs and committees. She's seeing a circuit board. She is seeing architecture. She's seeing a designed
That
system.
makes a lot of sense. The source actually mentions that her background in Silicon Valley is what tipped her off.
Yeah, right.
She saw the technological trajectory there, the centralization, the data gathering, all of it. And she identified it as a direct threat to individual sovereignty. She saw a machine being built in code.
And her argument here is that the machine of control didn't start with big tech. It didn't start with algorithms. It started centuries ago with the lodges.
The Masonic network is the analog predecessor to the digital control grid we see being built today.
Exactly. It was the original social network, but one that was designed for hierarchy and control, not just for connection.
So if we're going to look at this schematic, we need to get our terms straight because she makes a distinction right in the beginning that I think is crucial. She separates Freemasonry from Masonry.
Which is important to me, and I think to most people, those have always been synonyms.
They have. But for her argument, the distinction is vital. When she says Freemasonry with a capital F, She is being very specific.
She's talking about the secret society that was officially launched in London in 1717.
Right, the guys with the aprons, the compass, the square, the original organization. That's Freemasonry.
Okay, but then there's Masonry, lowercase.
Yes, and when she uses that term, she's casting a much, much wider net. She's talking about the whole ecosystem.
The hundreds of fraternal orders, the civic groups, the trade unions, the social clubs,
yeah.
All of it.
All the groups that were founded by Freemasons and are, she argues, controlled by them, but don't necessarily carry the name.
So Freemasonry is the headquarters.
But Masonry is the entire franchise, the whole network of subsidiaries.
Or, to use her background, maybe a better analogy is this. Freemasonry is the operating system running in the background.
Yeah.
Masonry is all the different applications on the screen, the user interface that the public actually interacts with.
That is a really helpful way to visualize it.
Yeah.
So the argument is that while 19th century Masonry was very visible, you know, big parades, presidents laying cornerstones for government buildings, wearing the sash and apron openly.
It was part of the public spectacle.
Yes. But something changed in the 20th century. The network evolved.
It did. She argues that the network realized that overt, obvious power breeds resistance. If you're too visible, you become a target. People know who to fight against.
So they fractured, they diffused, they split into hundreds of these innocent-sounding clubs.
All to covertly centralize government power. And the goal, according to the text, was to create a bureaucratic oligarchy.
A bureaucratic oligarchy. That sounds incredibly boring. But I guess that's the point.
Boredom is the ultimate camouflage. It has to be. Think about it. If you're being oppressed by a tyrant king, you know who to revolt against. You storm the castle.
You know where the enemy is.
Right. But if your freedom is being slowly eroded by a maze of committees and zoning boards and sub-agencies and community organizations, who do you even get angry at?
You just feel stuck in red tape. You're fighting a fog.
Exactly. And she argues this fog is manufactured. It's a design feature, not a bug.
Okay, so let's get into the structure of this fog. She describes a pyramid of power. And usually, you know, when we watch movies about secret societies, we focus on the guys in the hoods drinking wine out of skulls.
The shadowy figures making all the decisions.
Yeah. But Mrs. Heritage History, she spends a lot of time on the bottom of the pyramid, the base, the people she calls the seat warmers.
This is a fascinating, if somewhat cynical, take on organizational psychology. She asserts that the vast majority of modern Masons, the guys you might know in your town, the ones running the pancake breakfast, they are not evil masterminds.
They aren't Darth Sidious. They aren't casting spells or planning world domination.
No, not at all. She describes them as, and this is a quote, useful goyim, minions, essentially. Their role is simply to occupy space, to be a body in a chair.
So what's their purpose?
They are intended to be groomed for local politics, for school boards, for middle management positions in both government and corporations. But here's the catch, the real twist in her argument.
Yeah.
She argues that the system intentionally selects for mediocrity.
Wait, hold on. Why would you want mediocre people? If you're trying to run the world, don't you want the best and the brightest, the sharpest tools in the shed?
Not if you want total unquestioning control. Think about it. If you promote a man who is brilliant and self-sufficient and competent, he might question your orders.
He might have his own ideas. He might push back.
Exactly. But if you promote a man above his actual capability, if you put him in a position he isn't smart enough or talented enough to hold on his own merit, he becomes entirely dependent on the network that put him there.
He knows he's a fraud, and he knows that they know he's a fraud. He's compromised from day one.
Exactly. He owes them everything. He is utterly loyal because he has no other choice. The text says he cannot think outside the Masonic talking points box because he literally lacks the capacity to do so. He is a seat warmer.
He fills a chair that might otherwise be filled by an actual dissident or a genuine reformer who could cause trouble.
It's weaponized incompetence, and it serves as a brilliant cover. If a department is failing or public money goes missing, you don't suspect a conspiracy. You just blame it on bureaucratic incompetence.
Oh, Johnson's just an idiot.
Yeah.
It masks the malice with stupidity.
It's the perfect camouflage.
That is actually pretty brilliant. It explains a lot about the DMV, honestly.
It does.
But, okay, so if the base of the pyramid is just, for lack of a better term, useful idiots, Where are the decisions actually being made? Where is the apex of this pyramid?
The text suggests that the true power has migrated. It's not in the standard local Masonic lodges anymore. Those are just the recruiting grounds now, the vestibule.
Where is it?
The real elite, she argues, reside in far more exclusive, lesser-known groups, groups that operate above the public-facing lodges. The author lists some specific examples that most people might not even recognize.
She mentions the Society of Cincinnatus. I've heard that name before, but I couldn't tell you what they do.
It was founded right after the Revolutionary War by officers of the Continental Army. Membership is hereditary. It's very, very aristocratic, sort of American nobility.
Okay, so that's an old one. But she mentions modern groups, too, like Jason.
Jason, all caps, J-A-S-O-N. It sounds like a villain from a slasher movie.
It does. What is it?
It's a highly secretive group of elite scientists, mostly physicists, engineers, computer scientists. They were established during the Cold War to advise the U.S. government on defense and technology.
So these are the people working on the really heavy stuff.
The heaviest. Nuclear warfare strategy, climate modification, advanced surveillance tech. They operate with almost zero public oversight. Mrs. Heritage History argues that groups like Jason or the Atlantic Council or the Cosmos Club in D.C., these are where the meta-secret society really operates.
And she ties all this directly into the military intelligence complex.
Yes. She argues that these occult networks within the military and intelligence communities are where the diabolical plans, as she puts it, are actually hatched.
So the local Mason is just there to make sure the stop signs get put up correctly and the school curriculum doesn't get too radical.
And to provide a veneer of respectability for the whole enterprise. Meanwhile, the real architecture of control, the surveillance state, the forever wars that is being designed in these elite, rarefied stratospheres.
It's interesting that she calls it a meta-secret society. It implies something operating on a different level. And she goes into the history of how this started. She talks about speculative Freemasonry appearing in London in 1717.
Right. And to understand why that was such a big deal, you have to know what came before it. Before 1717, you had operative guilds.
If you were a stonemason, you joined the Stonemason Guild to protect your trade secrets. If you were a baker, you'd join the Baker's Guild. It was vocational. It was about your job.
It was practical. But speculative Freemasonry, as the name implies, was different. It changed the rules of the game completely.
I see.
It became philosophical. It wasn't about building with stone anymore. It was about building society. It deliberately broke the old class and trade barriers.
So suddenly you had a lodge where a duke, a wealthy merchant from the city, and an international moneylender could all sit in the same room and call each other brother.
Which, in the 1700s, was absolutely revolutionary. You just didn't mix social classes like that. It was unheard of.
And that's why it was so powerful.
Exactly. It became a neutral networking hub that allowed secret knowledge, financial deals, and political influence to bypass all the traditional structures of society.
Mm-hmm.
It was the original old boys club, but one designed from the ground up to consolidate power across different previously separate sectors of the elite.
So that's the structure. The seat warmers at the bottom providing cover, the elite at the top making the plans, all connected by this philosophical operating system. But the part of the article that really blew my mind was what she calls the sprawl.
The sprawl, how they moved from the lodges on the corner to every corner of Main Street.
This is the historical evolution section she lays out, specifically between 1864 and 1900.
Right, the post-Civil War era. She calls it the rise of the fraternal orders. And her argument is that they started deliberately spawning new organizations to target specific demographics.
It's like market segmentation for secret societies.
It is exactly market segmentation. They realized they couldn't force everyone into the same Masonic lodge. Different people need different branding. So they created different flavors of the same product.
Let's dig into some of these because the examples are pretty wild. She starts with the Knights of Pythias, founded in 1864.
Founded by a man named Justice Rathbone. Now, the context here is absolutely crucial, 1864.
The Civil War is raging.
And the federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. is expanding at an explosive rate to manage the war effort. Rathbone, who was a government clerk, founds this order specifically for government employees.
So it was a secret society exclusively for federal bureaucrats.
Essentially, yes. The text argues the goal was to secure loyalty and create a cohesive network within this rapidly growing administrative state. Think about the implications of that.
If you're a clerk in the War Department and your boss is a brother knight, and the guy you need a favor from in the Treasury Department is also a brother knight,
you form a protected class. A tribe within the government. It solidifies a culture where the bureaucracy protects its own first rather than serving the public.
It's like a union for the deep state before the deep state even existed.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Then you get the more social clubs. The Elks, founded in 1868. The Moose, 1888. I mean, I grew up thinking these were just places where guys went to drink cheap beer and, you know, escape their wives for a few hours.
And on the surface, they were. That was the appeal. They also offered mutual aid, which was huge.
Insurance benefits, right?
Yes. Remember, this is before the modern welfare state. There was no social security, no disability. If you got sick or you died, your family was completely destitute. These orders offered a safety net, a death benefit, sickness pay. That was the hook.
A very powerful hook. But the author points to a really dark underbelly for some of these. Specifically, she calls out the Fraternal Order of Eagles, founded in 1898.
This is one of the most provocative claims in the entire text. The official founders of the Eagles are listed as theater owners. Their names were Court, Leavitt, and Considine.
Which sounds fancy. You know, patrons of the arts. Cute. High society.
But Mrs. Heritage History argues we need to understand what theater owner meant in the context of 1898. We aren't talking about Broadway producers putting on Shakespeare. We're talking about vaudeville. We're talking about the so-called sporting life.
Meaning gambling and prostitution.
Precisely. The text claims this was a common euphemism for proprietors of vice rings. Organized crime.
So the Fraternal Order of Eagles.
Right.
Which today has this image of being so patriotic and wholesome. Was potentially founded by the proto-mafia.
That is the direct argument she makes. And if you think about it from a strategic perspective, it's brilliant. If you're running an illegal gambling operation or a chain of brothels, you are constantly at risk of being raided by the police.
Right. It's a precarious business.
What if you found a fraternal order
mm-hmm.
and you invite the local police chief to join and the local judge?
And the mayor.
And you give them all fancy titles, a secret handshake, and you do a charity drive for orphans once a year. Suddenly, you are not a crime boss. You are a pillar of the community. It's reputation laundering on an industrial scale. It creates a legitimate, respectable front for completely illegitimate activities.
It's the perfect cover.
And then for the upper crust, for the elite Masons, you have the Shriners, founded in 1870.
The guys with the red fezzies and the little cars.
The very same. But notice the exclusivity. You cannot just walk in off the street and become a Shriner. It's an invitation-only club for high-level Masons. You have to be a 32nd-degree Mason or a Knight Templar first.
So it's a club for the inner circle, a higher level of the pyramid.
Exactly. It's another layer of the onion.
Why the whole Middle Eastern theme? The fezzes, the scimitars, the Arabic names for their temples?
The text alludes to this being a nod to what they believe are the ancient pre-Christian roots of their secret knowledge. It's a way of symbolically separating themselves from the mainstream Christian tradition of the West.
Okay, so that's the 19th century sprawl. But then the 20th century hits and the vibe shifts again. The author argues we move away from the rituals and the funny hats and we get the rise of service clubs.
This is the shift to modern corporate style respectability. The author highlights two big ones. Rotary International, founded in 1905, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, founded in 1912.
And again, the claim is that these weren't just spontaneous gatherings of well-meaning businessmen.
No, not at all. The founders were Masons. Paul Harris, the founder of Rotary, was a Mason. But the real heavyweight here, the one she focuses on, is the Chamber of Commerce. The key figure mentioned is a man named Frank Vanderlip.
That name sounds vaguely familiar. Why does that name matter?
Because Frank Vanderlip wasn't just some local business owner. He was a titan of finance. He was the president of National City Bank of New York, which was essentially the Rockefeller family's bank.
A major player.
A huge player. And, crucially, he was one of the handful of men who met in total secret on Jekyll Island in 1910 to draft the legislation that created the Federal Reserve.
Wait a minute. So the guy who helped create the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, also helped set up the U.S. Chamber of Commerce just 2 years later.
Correct. And for the author, that connection is not a coincidence. It is vital to her entire thesis.
So what's the argument? What was the mission of these clubs?
She argues that the mission of clubs like Rotary, the Lions, Kiwanis, and especially the Chamber of Commerce, was to groom compliant community leaders who would support the establishment agenda.
And by establishment, she means the big banking interests, the federal government.
She calls it the Arno Demo Globalist Uniparty. Her idea is that you create a nationwide network of local influencers, small business owners, lawyers, doctors, who will all align with the federal and financial agenda being pushed from the top.
So if the Federal Reserve wants to push a certain economic policy, they need the local business leaders on Main Street to buy in.
And the Chamber of Commerce becomes the transmission belt for that ideology. It creates the illusion of grassroots support for top-down policies.
It does seem suspicious how fast they all spread. I mean, it's like suddenly between 1910 and 1920, every single town in America just had to have a Rotary and a Kiwanis Club.
It was a centralized rollout. The text argues it wasn't organic growth, it was infrastructure building. They were laying the cables for influence in every single zip code in the country.
So they've captured the social scene, they've captured the business networks. But, you know, soft power only gets you so far. Eventually, you need to enforce the rules.
You need hard power.
And according to Mrs. Heritage History, that's where the police and the unions come in.
This is section 3 of her argument, the enforcement mechanisms. If you control the social hierarchy, that's great. But you also need to control the means of coercion. And the text points specifically to the Fraternal Order of Police, the FOP.
She does a visual analysis of the FOP logo in the article. And I have to say, once she pointed it out, I couldn't unsee it.
It is quite blatant, isn't it? She just asks the reader to look closely at the emblem.
Okay, so what does she see?
Well, first, you have the all-seeing eye right at the top. The classic Masonic symbol of surveillance or the great architect.
The eye in the pyramid. You see it on the dollar bill. It's unmistakable.
Unmistakable. Then you have a pentagram, a five-pointed star, right in the center. And below that, you see the checkerboard floor.
The black and white tiles. That's straight out of a Masonic lodge, isn't it?
It is one of their most primary symbols. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to represent the duality of light and dark, good and evil, the pavement of the Temple of Solomon, and finally, the colors, blue and gold. The accusation here is stark. The text claims this isn't just branding, it signifies ownership.
So what are the real-world implications of the police force being, at its core, a fraternal order?
Favoritism. The blue wall of silence is just one manifestation. The text claims this Masonic infiltration leads to a culture where members get a literal get-out-of-jail-free card.
We've all heard stories like that. Officer pulls someone over, sees the FOP sticker on their car, and suddenly the ticket disappears. Oh, he's a good guy. Let him go.
Exactly. But she frames it as deep structural corruption. If the officer on the beat and the offender in the car share a secret handshake and an oath, does the law truly apply equally to everyone?
The answer is obviously no.
She argues it does not. And deeper than that, she claims it leads to a systemic failure to investigate protected criminal networks. Let's go back to the theater owners we talked about earlier, the Vice Lords.
The founders of the Fraternal Order of Eagles.
If those men are in the same lodge as the police chief, are their gambling dens and brothels ever going to be seriously raided?
Probably not. And if you do somehow get arrested, you end up in court.
Where, according to the source, the judges are often vetted by Masonic insiders. The assertion is that this destroys any public confidence in equal justice because the judiciary is captured by the very same network as the police. It becomes a closed loop of protection for its members.
That's a terrifying thought. But she doesn't stop at the law. She goes after the labor unions, too.
Which feels counterintuitive to a lot of people.
It does to me. I always thought unions were the anti-establishment force. You know, the workers fighting the corporate bosses.
That is the traditional narrative we're all taught. But Mrs. Heritage History argues that key Masons founded many of the major unions, the Knights of Labor, the AFL, the Teamsters, the UAW, specifically to control the workforce, not to empower it.
To control them how? I don't follow.
Think about it from the perspective of an oligarch. A mob of angry, unorganized workers is unpredictable and dangerous. They might burn down your factory. They might actually start a revolution.
A chaos.
But if you organize them into a union, you give them a structure. You give them a leadership hierarchy. You give them official channels for their anger.
And if you control the leadership of that union,
you control the mob. She argues these unions were created to manage the working class, to channel their energy into lobbying for big government, which benefits the bureaucracy, and to gatekeep dissidents.
What does that mean, gatekeep dissidents?
If a rank-and-file worker has a truly radical idea that threatens the core of the system, the union leadership can just shut him down. They can marginalize him. They only promote the team players who play ball with the establishment.
So it's controlled opposition. You build the container so you can contain the inevitable explosion.
Precisely. It gives the illusion of an adversarial system while ensuring the house never loses.
There's one more pillar of enforcement she mentions, and this one might step on some toes. Religion.
It will. She goes there. Specifically, Mormonism.
Right. The text claims a very strong foundational link between Masonry and the founding of Mormonism back in 1830.
Well, it's historical fact that Joseph Smith was a master Mason. That's not in dispute.
And historians have long noted the striking similarities between Masonic temple rituals and Mormon temple ordinances. The handshakes, the symbols, the clothing.
Yes. But Mrs. Heritage history isn't just focused on the theological parallels. She focuses on the geopolitical impact. She points to the geographic dominance of this group in the American West.
The Mormon Corridor.
Yeah.
Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, Nevada, Arizona.
Right. She argues this creates a massive, reliable voting bloc that almost always aligns with establishment lines on key issues. But she goes further than that. She mentions the heavy, disproportionate recruitment of Mormons into the FBI, the CIA, and the military.
I have heard that before.
Mm.
The standard explanation you always hear is that they're great recruits because they tend to be sober, they're patriotic, they're physically fit, and they often speak a second language from their mission trips.
That is the standard explanation, yes. The author suggests there is a deeper reason.
Which is?
That they are already part of the broader network, that their culture is already primed for hierarchy, for secrecy, and for obedience to authority, which makes them ideal candidates for intelligence agencies.
So it's not a coincidence. It's a feature.
That's her argument. She also briefly lists Christian Science, founded by Mary Baker Eddy and Jehovah's Witnesses, founded by Charles Taze Russell, as having Masonic connections in their founding leadership. The implication is that even our spiritual lives have been infiltrated by this grid of control.
So whether it's your church, your job, your police force, or your local social club, the argument is that this Masonry network is the invisible scaffolding holding it all together.
A scaffolding designed to keep the official structure standing and to keep you safely within that structure.
Which brings us to the ugly part. The reason for all of this,
right.
Corruption. Because you don't build a machine this complex just to have potlucks and charity drives.
No, you build it to extract value and to consolidate power. But section 4 of her argument is interesting because she starts by debunking what she calls the hysteria.
Right. She says to stop focusing on the Hollywood stuff.
She calls it a deliberate distraction. She argues that if you are looking for Satan worship or blood oaths in your local lodge, you are missing the real point entirely. The average Mason, the seat warmer, isn't doing any of that.
They're just
fixing
parking tickets for their buddies.
It's what she calls banal administrative corruption. Racketeering, bribery, insider dealing on local projects, election fraud at the municipal level. It's the zoning board approval that shouldn't have happened but did because the developer is a brother.
It's the government contract that went to the brother-in-law even though his bid was higher.
Exactly. It's boring corruption. It's not sexy.
Boring but pervasive.
Yeah.
And because it's so boring and so common, we just ignore it. We accept it as just how things work.
We don't see it as a conspiracy. We just call it networking. But she argues this is the primary engine of the oligarchy. This is how the wealth is siphoned off day by day in 1,000 small, unnewsworthy ways.
But, and this is a very big spoiler, she doesn't let the network off the hook entirely when it comes to the dark stuff.
No, she does not. And this is where the conversation shifts from the banal to the truly disturbing. She concedes that at the very highest levels of the pyramid, in those real elite circles, the inner core of the military intelligence complex, the rituals, do become transgressive.
Transgressive is a polite word for it. She talks about cult conditioning.
The idea is that you need a way to ensure absolute unbreakable loyalty from the people at the very top of the pyramid. You need something stronger than just we're in the same club. You need leverage. You need blackmail. You need mutual self-destruction.
If you do something truly terrible in a room full of powerful people, you can never, ever betray that room.
Yeah.
Because they have you.
Exactly. It binds you to the group through shared guilt and shared secrets. If everyone in the inner circle is compromised, then the circle is unbreakable. And the source explicitly claims that in these innermost circles, the rituals can include human sacrifice.
Whoa, okay, hold on. That is a massive leap. We just went from fixing parking tickets to ancient blood sacrifice. Does she offer any concrete evidence for that, or is this where we move into pure speculation?
She doesn't offer, you know, a smoking gun. She links it back to history. She references ancient Phoenician mulk offerings. She points out that much of Masonic symbolism and the London oligarch maritime traditions share these ancient Phoenician roots.
So she's making a historical connection.
Her argument is that the elite see themselves as the inheritors of this ancient pre-Christian power structure and its traditions, however dark they may be.
So the argument is, the local guy is fixing a traffic ticket and thinks he's a good Christian doing a favor for a friend, but the guy at the absolute top of the pyramid is participating in something ancient and horrific.
And the local guy provides the cover. The wholesome respectability of the Rotary Club pancake breakfast serves as a shield for the darkness of the inner circle. If you accuse the network of evil, they can just point to the scoreboard they funded and say, look at all the good we do.
That is a chilling thought. The good deeds are a shield for the bad deeds.
That's the mechanism she describes.
So why? Why build this whole machine? What is the end game? Section 5 of her analysis talks about the grand historical strategy. And this is where the historian in Mrs. Heritage History really comes out. She divides this into distinct phases.
Phase 1, continental masonry. This is 18th and 19th century Europe.
What was the goal there?
In a word, revolution. The goal was to destroy the old Christian feudal nobility. You have to remember, in old Europe, land and power were tied up in hereditary entailments and controlled by the church. If you were a wealthy merchant or a banker, you couldn't just buy your way into the top tier of power. The kings and the bishops held all the keys.
So you need a revolution to break that system.
You need anti-Catholic, anti-monarchist revolutions to seize the land and break the power of the church. You install republics run by politicians. And why do you do that? Because politicians can be bought. And more importantly, republics can borrow money.
It always comes back to money. Debt-based systems.
Kings can just default on their loans or, you know, cut off your head. A republic has a constitution. It has to service its debt. This was the mechanism, she argues, for transferring power from the landed aristocracy to the financial oligarchy.
Okay, so that's Europe. What about America? Phase 2, Anglo-American masonry in the 19th century.
The goal here was different. It was expansion and commerce, manifest destiny.
But she has a very controversial take on the American Civil War.
She does. She doesn't see it as just a fight over slavery. She argues it was forced by financial interests. She claims it was triggered by the political battle over shutting down the Second Bank of the United States. She links the National Bank Act of 1863, which allowed for foreign financing of the Union war effort, directly to the Masonic agenda.
So getting America hooked on foreign debt from the very beginning.
And then look at the Gilded Age that followed the war. The massive influx of European gold, the explosive industrial expansion, and the westward expansion. She makes a very specific point here. She notes that Masons established the territorial governments in 9 of the Western states.
They wanted to ensure that as the map filled in, it was filled in with their nodes.
Exactly. They were laying the fiber optic cables of power before the states even officially existed. If the first territorial governor is a Mason, then the first laws, the first judges, and the first mayors will all be members of the network. You build the state from the ground up to be part of the system.
Which brings us to the 20th century, phase 3.
Consolidation and centralization.
The great shift of power from the states to the federal government.
And the author quotes FDR here to make her point. And we should remember, FDR was a very high-level Mason himself.
What's the quote she uses?
To bring about government by oligarchy. The sovereignty of our states must be destroyed.
Did he actually say that publicly? That's an astonishing quote.
The quote is provided in the source. Whether it was a public speech or a private letter isn't specified, but it perfectly aligns with the strategy she is describing. The goal was to move power away from local communities and states where it's hard to control everyone and move it to a centralized federal government in Washington, D.C.
But wait, that seems to contradict what you said earlier. You said they fractured into all these little clubs in the 20th century. How does fracturing fit with centralization?
That is the absolute genius of the modern strategy. It's both at the same time. You centralize the authority in the federal government, but you administer that authority through a Byzantine bureaucracy of special interest groups, NGOs, agencies, and committees.
The seat warmers.
Yes. You create a system so complex, so filled with committees and subcommittees and advisory boards, that real power becomes completely invisible. The seat warmers from the local Rotary and Lions clubs fill the chairs. They follow the procedures, and the real decisions, the ones that matter, are made in the shadows by the elite.
It's the administrative state, the swamp.
Run by the network.
Wow. It really is a structural analysis. She's not just pointing fingers. She's describing the blueprints of the Death Star, basically.
She's describing a machine designed to bypass the consent of the governed while maintaining the illusion of democracy.
So where does that leave us? I mean, we've covered the structure, the history, the corruption. Mrs. Heritage History, our Stanford engineer, has laid out a pretty terrifying map of power in America.
She has, and I think her synthesis, bringing it all together at the end, is the most important part. She sees this Masonic network as the analog predecessor to modern tech control.
What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, let's go back to her biography. She warns about Silicon Valley threatening individual sovereignty, right? She argues that this Masonic network was version 1.0 of that same project. It was a social technology, a way to manage the masses, to shape society, and to control outcomes, all without the public realizing they were being managed.
Before we had algorithms to shape our opinions, we had lodges.
Precisely. Before we had data mining to identify troublemakers, we had the useful goyim in the Lions Club reporting back on who in town was a dissident.
Before we had shadow banning on social media, we had the union leader making sure you couldn't get a job if you spoke out of turn.
It's the same principle that is deeply unsettling. It implies that the technology changes, but the fundamental intent, the drive to control, remains exactly the same.
The intent is the erosion of individual sovereignty, the replacement of an organic, bottom-up community with a managed top-down community.
So the next time you drive into one of those towns and you see that Welcome To sign,
don't just look at the logos. Ask yourself, why do these groups exist? If they are merely charitable and social, why the need for secret oaths? Why the elaborate rituals and the secrecy? Why this constant tight alignment with banking and government power throughout history?
And ask yourself this final question. Does the fractured nature of modern masonry, the fact that it's split into 1,000 harmless-looking pieces like the Rotary, the Elks, the Moose, make it less powerful?
Or does it just make it infinitely more difficult to spot?
That is the question we are going to leave you with today. A huge thank you to the author, Mrs. Heritage History, for this incredibly detailed and eye-opening analysis. Her work at heritagehistory.com is definitely worth checking out if you want to see what history looks like through the eyes of an engineer.
Keep looking at the signs. We'll see you next time.